Hi, this is Meredith Foster. This is the Epic Podcast. Enjoy.
I was done with the drugs. I broke down in the shower. I was just bawling and sobbing, and I got down on my knees, and I just prayed to God to just get me out of that situation and to get me back in my daughter's life. And I remember praying, and I don't care what it takes. I will do what it takes. I pray that you can do this for me.
Everybody has a story, and everyone is a chapter, a piece of a much bigger picture. Welcome to Epic.
A great big story
that's been happening since
the beginning.
It's filled with redemption,
suffering,
hope,
and power.
And power.
It has many characters.
And so you and I
are a part of it.
We're not the hero. This is Epic.
Hi, this is Meredith Foster. A.W. Tozer said, there are no unknown Christians, no insignificant sons of God. But life and the experiences we encounter can convince us otherwise. We not only feel insignificant, but unloved and unworthy. For Tessa Ratajczyk, life from a very early age included alcoholism and domestic violence. She experienced abuse as a child. So as she grew, she repeated that behavior in her relationships. She was, in her own eyes, not worthy of anything more. Drugs led to domestic violence, and eventually Tessa found herself trapped in a life of abuse and fear and feeling like there was no way out. She cried out to God, but she didn't feel worthy of his help. It took a horrific event to forge in her an unshakable understanding of her significance in God's eyes. Just a word of caution. Today's is a hard story, especially if you've experienced domestic violence. You may find some of the details of Tessa's experience too difficult to hear. This is Chapter 39 of Epic, Tessa Ratajczyk's story.
Before the event happened, my life was the darkest it had ever been. Growing up, from the outside looking in, it really looked like I had the ideal life. You know, we had nice things. All of us kids were in sports. Our mom had, you know, a good job, all of those things. But what people didn't realize is that we grew up in a home filled with domestic violence and alcoholism. And really, anybody that's been in that kind of situation knows how easily that cycle is repeated on an unconscious level. Like, you don't realize it until you're in it. So I grew up, and, you know, after different abuses throughout my life, then I started acting out and coping in negative ways. And then when I got old enough to be in relationships, my ideal of what relationships were, they just weren't really iconic, I guess you could say. I had my nanny and my papa, who I looked up to greatly. I lived with them a lot throughout my childhood, and they were the people that I really modeled, good people after, with good relationships, mm-hmm. Very God-fearing. You know, they were very, you know, leaned on God to help with their relationship, and they were very heavy influence in my life. But then my papa passed away when I was 13, and they live mm-hmm. in Arkansas, so I was very back and forth. And then I got into a unhealthy relationship. I was 15, and he was much older than I was. And that relationship quickly turned violent. We used drugs. We both used, and then I ended up being pregnant. And I remember being a teenager praying for something just to kind of help us get on the right path. And I certainly was not praying for a baby. But at 16, I ended up pregnant with my daughter, who I named Patience. And she really helped turn both of our lives around, but the violence was still there. So eventually I got out of that relationship. But when I did, at that point, I was so isolated from my own family, my own friends. That's the way it works for the most part when you're in an abusive relationship with somebody. And it's not something that just happens overnight. Mm-hmm. It's something that, unless you're in that situation or you know someone that has been in it, you don't realize that you don't fall in love with an abuser. You fall in love with that mask that they're wearing and that person that they show you that they are and say they are. And, you know, they don't just pull it off real quickly one day. It's a little at a time. And then by then you love them. And a lot of times you have children with them, or you've isolated yourself. So by the time I finally got away, I ended up homeless. I ended up turning to drugs again. And I was living a very, very bad life, very far from God at this point. And growing up, I've always believed in God. I have always prayed. I've gone to church most of my childhood, and honestly off and on through my adult life. So fast forward just a little bit, I ended up in another abusive relationship, and this person that I was with was also an addict. I was still an addict at this point. I hadn't seen my daughter in months.
So she was no longer with you? And
no.
You lost custody?
I had lost temporary custody of her. He got custody of her temporarily, and I just lost it. I went the complete opposite way of what I should have done. I broke down. I turned to drugs. I was staying with one of the only family members I was in contact with, my sister. And we were both struggling with addiction at that time. And we both enabled each other, and we both were in a very bad lifestyle. I was in a couple relationships that just weren't very good, but nothing really stuck until I got with my ex, Christopher. And he, I thought, was different. It was one of those relationships, you know, usually it always starts out so great. They say all the right things, and they tell you what you need to hear, and, you know, they pretend to be who you need at that moment. And I fell in love with this man. We were very, very heavy into the drug life at this point, and I had been for quite some time. It was coming up close to a year, and I was exhausted. And I just wanted to be with my daughter again. I wanted to be worthy of being with my daughter again.
And you felt unworthy?
Unworthy. Mm. I felt unworthy of all things good. And at this point, I still prayed, but I did not feel worthy of redemption. I did not. And I knew better. You know, I know that's not how God's love works.
It feels,
you know,
real.
Tell yourself that when you're in that moment. Right. And it's not so easily believed. That relationship had turned violent very quickly. We were not together for very long before it did. It was a few months of bliss until one day we got into an argument and it escalated and it got physical. And then after that, every argument after that was just worse and worse. And then there was this intense jealousy and control. And I reached a point where I was done. I was done with the drugs. I broke down in the shower. I was just bawling and sobbing, and I got down on my knees and I just prayed to God to just get me out of that situation and to get me back in my daughter's life. And I remember praying, and I don't care what it takes. I will do what it takes. You know, just, I pray that you can do this for me. I pray that's your will, that I'm able to get out of this and to do better and to be better. In that situation, you're walking on eggshells. You're scared of saying the wrong thing, or
don't know what's going to be a trigger.
Lord forbid you look at his friend for a moment too long, or you just, you know, you don't cook his food the right way. Like, who knows? It's, you never know. And that's where that fear comes from. That's where that anxiety comes from, is because you don't know. And sometimes you get to a point where you're like, I just want to get this out of the way. Can you know, we just blow the bottle, you know, the lid off the top and just get it over with.
What an exhausting way to live.
It was. It was very exhausting in every way, physically, emotionally, spiritually, in every single way. But it came to a head in one of our most physical fights that we had after arguing. And I had told him that day, you know, if you leave, you know, I'm done. Because at this point, I was done with the drugs. I asked him to get sober with me. And he wasn't interested. And due to the drugs that we were on, the paranoia was intense. And it had been less than 3 weeks that I had been sober for, you know,
you were able to quit.
Yes, but not for very long. It wasn't for very long before this happened. I would like to think that, oh yes, that was the time that stuck. But you know, when I think about the truth of it all, I probably would have relapsed again had it not been for what happened. Had, you know, my new life really not been fortified, and for lack of a better way of saying it, actually been forged in that fire. So he left, and I went out of town. I was gone for about 4 days, went to some concerts with some friends, and, you know, had some fun with people that actually just wanted to be sober and enjoy life, and it was so beautiful. And, you know, I talked to my daughter on the phone and told her how much I loved her, and, you know, I kept trying to get back because I was so scared of, the longer I stayed gone, the more mad he was going to be. And I just wanted to get back to get my things and to just be done. And I don't know why I was so worried. It wasn't very much. It was just some clothes and just a few bucks I had saved up so I could try to get on a bus to go to stay with my ninny in Arkansas to, you know, to really give the sobriety thing a real chance, a real shot to get away from that life. And I went back to get my things, and he was not supposed to be there. So I just went there, was going to get my stuff, and I opened the screen door, and I had my hand on the door to open the main door, and he pulled up on the motorcycle. And I just had this feeling in my gut, like, just walk away, just, you know, nothing in there matters, just get out of there and go, and I didn't listen to it. I went in there, and he was very sweet at first, and then after we, you know, made up, so it seemed, he just instantly turned on me and started calling me very horrible names, and started slapping me around and started going through my purse and throwing things everywhere. And I tried to get my things and leave. He took my phone from me. And he had friends sitting on the couch during this time. And I couldn't tell you exactly how long it was. I think it was a couple of hours. It felt like eternity. It could have been more. It could have been less. But for however long it was that he had decided, I was there for him to do what he wanted and to make me pay for everything he was angry about in life. One of his friends ended up getting up and walking away. And I guess he had seen enough. And I wanted to say, you know, take me with you. Help me, let me leave with you. And before I could even get it out, the door was shut. And I knew in that moment that I was not going to get out of that house.
Tessa had felt trapped in the relationship, trapped in drug addiction, trapped in a life that was so far from what she wanted. And now there seemed to be no way out. The journey ahead includes a horrific tragedy that forever changed Tessa's life. If you've experienced domestic violence, you may find it difficult to listen. We'll share part two of her story coming up on Epic. Welcome back to Epic. Today we are hearing Tessa Ratajic's story. A word of caution, her story includes details of a horrific event that changed her life forever. If you've dealt with domestic violence, it may be especially hard to hear. This is part two of Tessa's story.
One of his friends ended up getting up and walking away. And I guess he had seen enough. And I wanted to say, you know, take me with you. Help me, let me leave with you. And before I could even get it out, the door was shut. And I knew in that moment that I was not going to get out of that house. I wasn't going anywhere until he decided that it was time that I could, or if I could. And I had fought so hard, and he told me to, in less vulgar terms, to shut up and to sit down in the recliner. And I just didn't have any fight left. So I did, and I sat down, and, you know, he was in front of me, standing in front of me and yelling, and I just said, you know, life doesn't have to be such hell. I'm sorry, that's vulgar, but that's what I said. So life doesn't have to be such hell. You don't have to make mine that way, and you don't have to make yours hell either. And he said, I'll show you hell. I will put you there. Those words I still hear sometimes in my nightmares. I will never be able to forget those words. But of course, me, and I've got a little bit of a mouth on me, so I said, I'm already there, Chris. I'm already there. And by the time I said that, he had stepped around the corner, grabbed a jug. He was in front of me with the lid off and doused me twice. The first time the liquid hit me, my arms went up like this. And I just screamed because it burnt my skin when it got me.
What was it? What was in the jug?
Industrial strength brake cleaner. Then he doused me a second time, and my arms, this right here and my feet, are about the only spots. They don't have any kind of scars at all because of how I put my arms up like this.
Oh, my goodness.
And he doused me a second time, and then I brought my arms down, and he lit the lighter. And you've probably heard a bonfire that has had some sort of flammable liquid on it, that sound it makes, you just go up. I made that noise.
Did you know immediately what had happened, or did it take a minute to register?
I think I knew immediately exactly what had happened. And I screamed and I stood up. Then the two friends that were sitting on the couch still, they got up and they ran out. And I threw myself down, and I tried to put the flames out, but with the brake cleaner, it just spread, and the carpet caught fire and the recliner was already on fire. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, like, this is it. And I just didn't think there was anything else I was going to do. And I was ready to give up fighting. And I wasn't, like, at peace with what was happening, but I had accepted it. But I was also scared, because I knew that in my heart I was not ready, and I was scared of where I might go. I wasn't living the way that I should have been. And I remember having that thought. And I just kind of thought that that was it, you know? And he gave me like this smirk, this look. Like I just, to me, it was like he thought he'd won and he just left. I got up. I saw that look just, it ignited something in me. And I just was like, no, this isn't the end. And, you know, nothing else could have gotten me out that door other than God. And they had left the main door open. And so I had to fight with the screen door still, though. And when I opened that, I made that noise all over again, that ignition noise. And you had to go like down a couple stairs, and that's where people pulled up. So it's gravel. So I had to run to the backyard, and I put myself out and all of that. And then I stood up and I saw damage, you know, what damage I could see. And I seen the skin just melting off of me. This was August, the end of August. So I was in shorts and a tank top, and my skin was literally melting. And I looked at my hands, and I was just holding them, and my fingers were pointed down, and they were still melting so slowly, and they were starting to curl. And it was just the craziest thing.
Shock?
It was. I was definitely in shock. And apparently there are two kinds of shock, where you go into shock and you don't really feel anything at all, and the kind of shock where you just feel every little thing. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I went into the latter where I felt everything. But that ended up benefiting me later on in trial because I could remember details. That's just one of the many things that, you know, at first glance, it's like, how horrible. But at the same time, you know, that pain had a purpose. You know, I was aware so that I could be aware and I could remember and I could testify to what happened. But a neighbor ran over, and I was in such shock when the first EMT guy still first got there. You know, they wanted me to lay down, and I just remember thinking I didn't have skin and I didn't need to lay down on that dirty ground any more than I had already laid down on. Like, and
it had to be excruciating pain.
It was the worst pain I've ever felt until I woke up from my coma. It's so hot that it's like cold in a way. And I know that probably doesn't make any sense. And I guess unless somebody's been burnt to a certain, you know, degree, they don't get it. But it's just so hot that you're cold and everything hurts and it still feels like you're on fire. All different kinds of pain. And like I said, I could feel everything, and I remember all of this. And they had to take me from West Frankfort, Illinois, to Heron, Illinois, to that hospital. And the last thing that I remember was the guy in the back, I don't know their names, but the guy by my head saying something to the driver, but it was muffled. And then the driver said, "Have the helipad ready. We're 3 minutes out." And that's the last thing that I remember. Well, apparently I had quit breathing. So they had to intubate me and get me breathing again before they could put me on the helicopter and lifeline me to St. Louis. So I don't have any real recollection of anything until I woke up from my coma.
And how long was that?
Just over 8 weeks. So about 2 months, I was in a medically induced coma so that they could do the surgeries and that I could heal. And
But then you woke up to excruciating pain?
Absolutely excruciating pain. And I've always been a bit of a fighter and quite stubborn, to be honest. But apparently I'd been trying to fight my way out of the coma for a little bit. I fought the breathing machines after a certain point, and that's how they knew I was ready to be able to breathe on my own. And I was just, you know, they were having a hard time keeping me under with the medication, so they had to amputate my fingers. And they wanted to keep me out for about a couple weeks at least after that. But myself and God had other plans, and I awoke about a week after that. And I woke up with family in the room. I had quite a few family members, and my mother was in there. And she was the first face I remember seeing. I remember opening my eyes and just kind of looking around and seeing the machines and my family.
Did you have any idea, any recollection at that point what had happened?
I did. My mother had started to tell me that there was a fire, and that my ex had done this to me. And I just said, you know, so this wasn't a nightmare. This is real. This really happened. And I just broke down. I looked at my fingers, and they were, you know, my everything was just, I looked like a mummy. And my fingers were wrapped up and swollen, but I could tell that a lot of them were, you know, a lot of each finger was missing. And I sobbed. And then all of a sudden, I don't know, I had this overwhelming peace And it's just like God just put his hand on me, and I stopped crying, and I looked at my mom. I looked her dead in the eyes, and I said, you know what? God has given me a second chance at life, and I'm going to take it, and I'm going to have an amazing life. And I have, and it has not always been easy. There have been a lot of struggles. You know, I've said multiple times, the only thing more painful than burning to death is burning almost to death and then living through that and recovering. But God has been a very big part of my recovery. From the time that I woke up, I knew that there was no other explanation. And I've had a few different times people ask me, you know, more or less, like, after everything that you've been through, how can you still believe in God, you know, after what you've been through and you made it through all that? And I was like, but did you hear yourself? After everything I've been through and I made it through it all, how could I not? Like, what other explanation could there be? And I knew from that point on that that was, you know, God's way of showing me that if I could do that I could do anything, that I just needed to keep that sense of determination and that attitude that, you know, I've already, you know, made it through the impossible.
It's already a miracle.
Yeah. So, I mean, everything else after this is, you know, just icing on the cake and, you know, really making a statement to what, you know, can actually happen. And so then I healed from my, you know, physically. I have to date had 21 surgeries, amputations, skin grafts, Z-plasties, which are releases to release scar bands. And so it's, you know, and I've got more to do periodically as my scars tighten up and they need to be loosened for mobility and for more comfort because it is painful. But, you know, I was so focused on healing because I wanted to heal so that I could see patients, my daughter, so that I could get back to what I was meant to do. To, you know, I was meant to be there to be your mom. And, you know, even though I had messed up and I, you know, it wasn't this perfect road, you know, in the end, it has made me a much better mother. And I love my children much more fiercely now. You know, everything that I've been through has given me the ability to look at things differently, to have you know, the perspective of how short our time on this earth is. But I focused so hard on healing physically. And then I was able to finally see my daughter and start to parent her again. But then I had to make sure that he was held accountable in court. So there was 2 years of court date after court date and hearing, and I went to everyone. And I didn't have to, but I needed to be able to represent not just myself, but for every person that has been hurt or abused and weren't able to stand up for themselves. I was one of the lucky and blessed ones where my abuser was actually held accountable. He was found guilty and sentenced to 30 years. And it's been very hard, but I've learned so much about myself. And I struggled my whole life with self-love. I also struggled with vanity and having, you know, constantly being worried about what people in this world thought about me. I spent way too much time and energy focused on that.
I think a lot of people can relate to that.
Yes, yes. And it's very hard. The world that we live in, you know, there are so many expectations, whether from the outside world or that we put on ourselves.
Yeah, and mostly unrealistic.
Yes, very unrealistic. Mm-hmm. And but I definitely had struggled with self-love, and it's kind of ironic in a way, but now covered in all these scars and missing a few pieces of myself, I am more whole than I have ever been before. I am still very much a work in progress, but I love who I am. I love the faith that I have. I love the fierce people that I have in my life, the people that support me. And I love that I've been able to take this pain that I've gone through, as immense as it has been. I have been able to take that pain and give it a purpose by turning it into something positive. A friend and I have started a support group and a nonprofit organization called Sisterhood of Trauma Survivors, where females of all backgrounds from all over the world that have been through any kind of trauma you can think of, we have this place where we come together and we share our stories and we support one another and we lift each other up and we find resources and we're growing, and it's amazing. And just to think that, You know, had I not gone through everything that I've gone through, if it wasn't for that, then I wouldn't be able to have my hands in this and helping all these other people and these women and changing lives. And it just really makes it all worth it. And there were times in the beginning where I wasn't sure I'd ever be able to say anything like that. But yeah. I can say that wholeheartedly and with complete certainty that it was worth it.
Tessa and I talked about how her situation could have easily gone a different direction. She could have ended up dead or in prison. She says only God could do what's been done. And she wants you to know that no matter where you are, no matter what you struggle with, there is always hope. God will help you and will provide a way out. If you're living with domestic violence, reach out for help. Call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-7233. We are so grateful to Tessa for sharing her story. You can learn more about her on our website at myfaithradio.com. So thankful to the crew who helped produce Epic, Jason Rakow and Ted Ross. Thanks to Stefan Johnson for our show's theme music. I'm your host, Meredith Foster. I'll see you next week. Thanks so much for listening. Every episode of Epic is made possible by people like you. You can make a gift today at myfaithradio.com. And if you love the show, let others know about it by sharing this audio link. You can make sure you never miss an episode when you subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or your favorite podcast player.